Michael Roncarati is Director of Rehabilitation for the Atlanta Hawks of the NBA. A fellow New Englander, Michael tells us all about his journey to the NBA, who should be doing what roles in a high-performance setup, and the uniqueness of management of lifestyle and recovery for NBA athletes. This long chat really covered every base, and I'm really excited to share it with you guys. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Well Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fuss. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Well-traveled wellness podcast. Today is the second call in a row. I'm actually calling within the same country. It's some kind of record for me. Calling up to Atlanta to speak to Michael Roncarati, Director of Rehabilitation with the Atlanta Hawks. Michael's been in the NBA for a while now. He was previously at the Golden State Warriors before switching coasts. He's had a really interesting journey starting in Massachusetts like myself. So to a fellow New Englander, welcome to the show, Michael.
Appreciate you having me, Jake.
Awesome, man. You are not a big outspoken social media person like many in our industry are. So why don't you start by introducing yourself to the audience and telling us a bit about how you got to where you are today?
Sure thing. So like you said, I'm a New Englander. Grew up in Rhode Island. I went to a PT school in Massachusetts at Northeastern in Boston. I did like the entry level DPT program there. So it was 6 years straight through. Always had an interest in strength and conditioning, being like an athlete growing up and always like caring about sports and trying to be active myself and push the limits of my own body and kind of being involved in personal training and coaching of athletes while I was at Northeastern. Definitely a huge interest in the performance side. So kind of like yourself, I interned with Eric Cressy at Cressy Performance. And then he kind of opened up my network to reach out to Bill Hartman, where I did my PT clinical. So those are kind of like the two big names in the industry that I work directly under. And then through those two names, I've been fortunate to meet a ton of great people and expand my network and meet some great like minds. So after school, and after like my clinical affiliations, when I became a licensed PT, I moved back to Rhode Island and worked in an outpatient orthopedic clinic there that was owned by doctors. So it was a physician-owned clinic. It also had a gym connected to it, like a sports performance gym. It was called South County Sports Performance and Orthopedics. And they were the sports medicine providers for URI. So I got to see a decent amount of athletes when I was there. The only team we didn't work with or didn't work for were was the men's basketball team. So I don't want to say it wasn't their best sport, so they weren't necessarily freak athletes, but they're Division I female and male athletes, football players, baseball players, gymnasts. So we saw all kinds of people like that, general population people, high school athletes, Medicare. So I got a good base or a good foundation in a wide array of kind of populations or subsets of people. Which I think was very beneficial for me. And then throw that on top of just having a gym right next door and being able to talk to coaches and being able to talk to doctors. I think it was a really good experience for me. I worked there for about 2.5 years. And then kind of, as you alluded to earlier, I got a call to for a job opportunity in the NBA where I functioned as a strength and conditioning coach. A buddy that I went to PT school with at Northeastern had been working in the NBA for clinicals as an intern, and then he had just finished up 2 years in Minnesota with the Minnesota Timberwolves, had an opportunity to take a job with the Warriors in Golden State, and he was able to bring me on. So I followed him out there, worked there for 2 years, more in like a strength conditioning realm. That was my title, and then took a job here because I saw it as we had an opportunity to kind of build a staff and work with Art Horn and Chris Chase, who are obviously great professionals, have a little bit of a social media game. And then Art's probably better known for the great work that he did at Northeastern, but also for putting on BSMPG, which was probably between that and Jada Mayo's conference, probably the two best conferences as far as like the quality presenter that they have. So got to come here and work with those types of people. So made that move. And then here I'm also in more of like a rehabilitation role that I also get to work on the strength conditioning side. So I get to blend a little bit more than I did in Golden State. And I think that's kind of why that, in addition to why I was, the people I was working with, it was a tough move. I really liked California, great group of guys, great organization, great coaching staff, but professionally, I thought this was the right move and still do. So, here I am today.
So Michael, if you were at, let's say, a family barbecue, and an uncle said, so what exactly do you do for the team? And then in a sentence or two, how would you describe your role today?
In a sentence or two, that's probably tough. That's tough for me because I'm kind of long-winded. I kind of ramble. But let's see. I mean, I think it's my job to try and work with the people of my staff to ensure that our players are able to play on the court and healthy. And what that means for each person – I mean, I'm specifically probably more involved in like the exercise and the movement type stuff, the musculoskeletal injuries that they might be predisposed to or kind of just dealing with in a tough season. And it's my job to help manage that and make sure that they can get on the court and play. And I would say that's like the exercise component, the manual therapy component. That's probably more my specialty. We have a staff that a nutritionist and so there's obviously a ton of ways you can take performance and you can improve performance, and giving people what they need is what we always try and do as a staff, figuring out what works for each individual and what's going to give them the most bang for their buck based on what they're asking for now. And obviously nutrition and sleep, that goes into how well someone moves or fatigue or whether they're predisposed to injury or not. But I wouldn't say, like, while I'm aware of that, we have other people on staff, and then we have kind of consultants that we work with on those kinds of problems. My problems are more like, all right, this dude has no hip internal rotation, he's limited in these joint capacities, and he looks like this when he moves, he feels his back doing this. It's my job to kind of troubleshoot that and put forth a plan and try and manage that so that we can get through the games and play.
Man, that's a pretty cool job, and I think we see it in the Australian football model. You know, teams are now having that bridge between just the strength and conditioning staff and the medical staff, and I'm not sure how your structure is, but just having someone who does the things you just described is extremely important. Quick interject, Mike. How important do you think it is for strength and conditioning professionals to acquire manual therapy skill sets?
I'll be honest. It's probably not something I'm a huge, huge fan of. And I'll say, like,
you think it should be left to the PTs?
Yeah. Again, like, I think manual therapy, I think a lot of things about this, but in just seeing what people are posting on the internet, and while I'm not on or actively involved in engaging in social media, like, I see what's put out there, and by no means am I like the standard bearer of what's right and what's wrong, but there's definitely I feel nowadays way more of a tendency for strength coaches to kind of be what I see as circumventing the process of going through 6 or 7 years of schooling to get these like LMT certifications at night.
Sure.
Just so they can try and do things that they might be better suited to refer out. And I think by doing that, like you don't necessarily, you're using a tool that's trying to be a fix for something you may not need and may not be able to have been subjected to clinical experiences or enough experience with different people to know, well, whether or not this works. And like what the line of delineation is between you're doing more than you should be and not, I think oftentimes is blurred. But I don't know. I just see a lot of strength conditioning coaches getting their LMT now, and not going through like this 6-year, 7-year process. Like, I'll be honest, I didn't love school, but it's something you got to do. I knew I wanted to be a PT. I knew I wanted to have this degree and these letters next to my name. So it's something you put up with, and it's tough to hear people calling themselves sports medicine providers, or clinicians, or like along those lines, and then not really going to school for it as a, and I'm not even saying like chiropractic, ATCs, PTs, like whatever it is. But if you're a credentialed, licensed healthcare provider, I think probably more of that stuff should be saved, especially the manual stuff, because we probably don't need our hands as much as people think.
No, you're right.
And frankly, like what commercial models are saying that they're doing with their soft tissue technique is I think kind of extrapolated, to say the very least. So like the physiological mechanisms of why manual therapy works are probably a lot more neural. And then it is anything with realigning tissue or collagen or anything like that. And to think your 20 minutes of manual work, if that's how long you do, or your hour of manual work is going to address force or align tissues according to the force you're directing through your hand. I think it's pretty silly, because as soon as that body gets off the table, the brain has to decide how it's going to hold the muscles and the movement strategy is going to use. And I promise you, active engagement in movement is going to be way more powerful stimulus, for your body and your tissues to adapt to. And your muscles adapt to what your brain is telling them to do, not the other way around. And again, something active where you're engaged and your nervous system has to figure out a solution to a movement task, the environment, or a problem, that's going to determine which motor units are firing, and again, how the body and how the segments are being loaded together, not 20 minutes on one spot or two spots, or not through this kind of, I would say, realignment anatomical model, which is often used. So,
well, that's a really interesting point there, and the bridge and, you know, the medical perspective, Michael, because I realize as I heard you answer that there are very different scopes inside versus outside of America on these things, especially around certifications and licensure. From my totally uneducated perspective, I do, you know, so to speak, believe in massage, or believe in manual therapy and the kind of human touch and what that can do, not for injury prevention, not for all the, you know, the things which you just spoke on, but maybe for just helping an athlete either recover better or else prepare for what they're about to do. And in that regard, I guess I should have said I see a difference between, I guess, a strength coach going and getting, say, that performance therapy, mini course at Altus, just having the scope to, you know, help with some dorsiflexion deficits or rub down a calf, rub down a hammy, you know, after a session kind of thing. You know, when they're on the road and they might only have one PT or one medical staff on hand, you know, you might see this at rugby sevens tournaments or more smaller team sport settings. There's obviously a huge difference between that and some guy who does a weekend course and starts dry needling or cupping or something, which is, you know, questionable and needs a lot more schooling than is provided.
For sure. And again, everything you just said, like if we're using the terms like the effect of touch, if the athlete wants this, if we're like, the as soon as you bring in like to improve dorsiflexion or something, that's where I'm like, because again, I don't inherently believe that a manual technique is going to do that. It might allow them to access it, but they have to know how to dorsiflex. They have to know how to be able to advance their knee over their heel or over their toe or forwardly translate their tibia.
It has to be a process,
for you to increase dorsiflexion. So it requires them. And again, like what we're finding more and more is that, like, again, like you said, the touch component. What is the chemical reaction? What is the top-down modulation of these manual therapies if an athlete expects it? And like you said, just for recovery, that's a very vague term. What does that mean? If a player has had massage after games his whole career, I would never take that away.
I'd say down-regulation would be what I meant.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. But it requires, some people are averse to touch. So it's like, that's where it's again, this is a lot of times modulated, not from your hands upwards, but from what the brain perceives of the experience it's undertaking right now. And I think that's just an important thing that we do. And like, should a strength coach be able to have these conversations? Yes. And like in a bind or in a punch. And again, I have a specific setting. Like, we work with massage therapists. We have 4 people on staff who can do manual therapy because we're licensed medical professionals, like, in this country. Like, I don't know what it's like to work for a D-League team where they don't have the resources. They might only have an ATC or strength coach, or let's just say they don't have a medical professional on staff and they got to be able to figure this out. They don't have the money to outsource, or they don't have access to a massage therapist. Then it's like, I don't worry, but like, the language that they use, what they're saying they do.
Sure. Yeah.
They better be smart in representing what science and physiology says, mm-hmm. and what they're really doing. That's all. I just think we need to be better stewards to what science is actually saying. We have to do things and say things that have biological plausibility. And I get very, the field is very frustrating and disenchanting sometimes with some of the things, the onus that treaters or practitioners put on themselves as far as describe what they're doing to people as being like their treatment. And it's,
yeah, I mean, it's the Wild West out there. It is. There's no doubting that.
But yeah, no, like it's, I think you should be aware, and I think if push comes to shove and you need to do that, if you need to put your elbow in a quad or something, like, I really don't have any problem with that, as long as you're saying I'm putting my elbow in a quad.
Right, right.
Presenting the touch component, the forceful kneading of tissue, or fine, but like, don't say you're realigning anything or
nerve flossing
or tissue or any of those kinds of things.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and that's a good delineation of that stuff. And oh, it's useful for me, Mike, to hear a different opinion there, because I'm probably gotten too comfortable in the mindset of, you know, oh, if we can help people achieve a certain range of motion, then they'll be able to move through that range of motion, and, you know, motor repatterning, so to speak, will happen on its own. But you're right that is a deliberate process that should be done by a deliberate professional, you know, with that specific skill set.
Yeah, and it's just like, in order for that to happen, I mean, I've seen manual therapy lock people up. So while they might like the aggressive touch, because that's what they associated with it, it actually locks them up more. So then, did you really increase, like things can only, you'll only get more movement from a joint system if the person receiving it and their body is open to it. And I've seen the opposite. Well, the person will get up and say they feel better. It's like, objectively, you lost motion. So was it too aggressive? Were they holding their breath? Were they fighting you? Could they not relax? You know what I mean? Like, all of those things matter. And ultimately, like that's going to be contingent upon what that person is feeling and how their nervous system is receiving the stimulus. So that's the whole reason why, for me, to say that you're loosening up something or you're gaining range of motion. Well, I hope you're testing to say that you actually did, and understand it's relaxation, and it's, You're using a sensory input to modulate I don't want to say neural tension in this case, but tone.
Sure.
Neuromuscular tone, and lots of things modulate neuromuscular tone to hopefully excurse more passively after said treatment. But you're not increasing their range of motion. Their nervous system has to be open to it. That's all.
Yeah. No, that's a huge point. That's a huge point. I think it's important for us to understand, and I hadn't really thought about it that way. Definitely already disagreed with some of the cowboy statements and posts being put out there, and definitely wasn't a fan of when people get the scraping or the cupping and, you know, post up their big bruises as if that's going to help them play better the next day. But the way you term those things makes a lot of sense.
And for some, it might. Like, that's what I mean. Like, some people love gua. I mean, I remember when I was younger and I wanted to get gua sha, and I wanted to be all the potential. I wanted those all over me, like cupping. Like, it's a sign that it worked. And does cupping work? For sure it can work. Absolutely. Like, if the person receiving it thinks it will make them better, by that notion, it works.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like I have no problem with any of those modalities, and they can be they can certainly be a part of a comprehensive athletic performance rehabilitation plan. Like, absolutely. It's just like, what is it doing objectively and why does it work? I just think we have to be better, better explainers to our athletes and then to other professionals about how it's actually working and why it is efficacious for some. And not just put it in these, like these grand blocks. Well, I compressed his tissue or removing blood, like it's increasing blood flow. It's like touching someone increases blood flow, exercising increases blood flow. Like that's why you're
going to do this.
So I like that. So it's those kinds of rationales for doing things that don't really strike me as being overly beneficial, certainly not for the progression of this field. Like if we want to be held in a higher regard and we want to be held in the same light as like MD someday and other primary care, practitioners, then like, I think we have to be better stewards of the science and say what we're actually saying and like be more accurate in what we're actually doing. Otherwise we'll just get laughed at and we won't be able to have like truly academic discussions with anybody involved in that kind of like rigorous research environment.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head there. I know, physios or PTs and S&Cs like to kind of make fun of each other or give each other crap. One of the things, if I was to pinpoint, that drives me nuts that physios or PTs do is they'll just do a treatment and they'll say, well, I'm doing this and that. And because I use big words, you have to believe me and let it go. You know,
right.
And I mean, it's not like S&Cs don't do the exact same thing. But, you know, you use the word I was about to use is objective. You know, what objective measures are we doing pre and post? Are we checking if they report better the next morning than they did that morning?
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. Like there has to be some objective. If you want to say you're realigning tissue or you're directing force in this way, then like, do you have histology on this person right now to show me that? And that, do you have ultrasound? Like that's the thing. That's why I try never to say anything like that. It's like, I usually just say, hey, we're trying to load your tissue. These muscles are usually firing with other muscles and they're being elongated or they're being contracted and shortening, like, and they're actively contracting. I'm trying to load your tissue in just a different way. And like, that's pretty much how I describe it. And again, there are lots of, but I'm not measuring what their, like different chemicals in their blood are that we know change from manual therapy or certain manual therapies in certain people. So it's like, I can't say that we're doing those things. I say we could be doing those things, but I usually just give you the explanation that I just gave you.
Right. So, but it's what you're not saying.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, I feel like we could go on about that for about 2 hours. It's a really, really interesting one. I wanted to ask you, so we were speaking before we went live about the schedule just kind of making the days all blend together. And NBA is about the craziest sport or league setting that you could find out there, especially from a physical preparation and wellness standpoint. So if your job is to help the players avoid injuries and help them, you know, work through injuries and come back from injuries, how do we do that in the crazy NBA environment?
So it's funny. We were having this discussion, and I mean, I know there's plenty of evidence to support this anecdotally and published to say, like, we've been a little bit more banged up last year, this year than we were last year. And it's funny. The people who have been didn't have a summer of training. So, I mean, I think where you get to put the biggest bang for your buck into this health and wellness throughout a season is there has to be some kind of regular and regimented training process that's occurring well in advance of the actual season. And it's about building capacity, fitness. We use the analogy, or I got to give Art Horn the credit for this. Like it's building a bank account, because we know that travel and lack of sleep and all of this is going to withdraw money from your bank account. Where you deposit is in the off season and how you take care of yourself in season as well. But a huge portion of that investment is coming out or is being put down with the work that you're doing in the off season and how you're taking care of yourself. And it's been pretty cool. Like I would say more than most NBA teams, although I bet this is becoming more of the norm now, like we have a lot of guys around all summer. But like three guys in particular this summer, like didn't miss a training session, and they're having right now career years. So it's like, it's cool to see that. And that goes a long way. And that's a testament to, I think, kind of them first off, but also like Chris Chase does a phenomenal job. And I think we work together well as a staff, as far, especially in this summer, to try and get, people. And we did a good job, really good job of working with the coaches this year on how to balance, like how much time is spent playing basketball during specific parts of the summer. And I got to give the coaches credit, because they're intuitive about like what they want to be doing at certain times. But like, there's times where, oh, players are around, let's just play pickup. But we kind of didn't allow pickup to happen until like the end of August into September, and then build a good base there. It was a lot of individual work and skill work for less than 20 minutes at the beginning of the summer, or the beginning of the off season, where the majority of their time, about an hour, hour and 15, was like devoted to their body and training in the weight room, running and conditioning, all that stuff. So like, it was a heavy emphasis on their body and training in the weight room outside of the basketball stimulus. So, I mean, that just has its benefits to prevent overtraining and just kind of the novelty it promotes from not doing the same thing and overuse of same kind of motor strategies in the same context over and over and over again. And just the monotony of that. So, the fact that the coaches were okay with that, were open to that, and the players kind of went along with it, I think is a testament to what we were trying to build as an organization, what we're trying to do. When you say in season, like how do we manage that? So for jumping athletes, what do we know a lot about as far as like what spares jumping athletes? It's, and what are jumping athletes' biggest complaints oftentimes? It's tendinopathy. So typically patellar tendinopathy and Achilles tendinopathy. So we spent a ton of time doing isometrics, and we spent a ton of time training in positions that are like of the lower developmental position. We spend a lot of time in half kneeling. We spend a lot of time in kind of side lying and all fours and things of that nature, to work on kind of different neuromuscular strategies than those that they're accustomed to using in the game. And a lot of times that just goes like that in and of itself is enough to kind of load their body in a different way and prevent this overuse and this fatigue. They're not as fatiguing, they're fatiguing, but in a different way. They don't tend to drain you. A lot of times people will feel better, or just feel like lighter is a word you hear a lot after they're doing it. So that's kind of how we do it in a weight room and in a rehab situation. We'll do like easy circuits of 5 or 6 exercise, where we just do like 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, or 2 or 3 rounds. We like doing those after games with our like middle minute guys. And it's, I mean, their heart rate doesn't get above 140. It's pretty rhythmic in nature. We tend not to do things of like a bilateral, like nothing, like it's not bilateral. They're not bilateral lifts. So they're not really push-ups. They're not really, it's not really squatting or hinging necessarily in those circuits. It's a lot of unilateral stuff that promotes rotation and just like reciprocation and alternating sides of the body. Just again for fluidity and prevent this like this just general stiffness and overload. And stiffness isn't a bad thing. I don't mean to say that in a bad way, but we just know they're subjecting their body to this 3.5 times a week, and with crazy travel demands and just the monotony of playing and practicing all the time. So it's definitely not easy. We try and, I mean, we talk a lot about sleep, and we have something this year where we get to hotels. We make sure that their room is set to specific temperatures to promote relaxation. Like their blackout curtains are already closed. Like we have some deals with hotels where they'll do that for us before we get there. Like the music isn't playing. A lot of times when you go into nice hotels, they got like, especially like Ritz-Carlton's, they'll have the TV on and like the music playing. And it's like, so that stuff doesn't happen as much as it used to. Just things like that. Like typical things we do, we use Normatec a lot, like on planes where we encourage Mark Pro use, which is just a little stim unit that kind of prevent, just causes little muscular contractions. It's EMS, it's electrical muscle stim. So those are like the passive recovery modalities we're using. And it's just like there's subjective questionnaires, obviously. So when people, we do have like a sports scientist now, who kind of analyzes our data for us. So, when he sees people that are trending in a way, he'll let us know. And then we have a conversation and we try and figure out what is it. And frankly, some of these things you can't control. They're just normal ebbs and flows of what the human body feels like when you're traveling, like we are, when you're playing as often as they are. There's just natural ebbs and flows of kind of how you feel on any given day anyway. And that's especially true when there's way less of a routine. So kind of, as you talked about earlier, like the NBA is crazy as far as the schedule and the travel is, it is. So that's where we have to be we have to try and be as proactive as we possibly can without being so demanding that we become, kind of like a burden too, just like another thing to check a box, another person that making them do something. So we have to try and figure out ways we can keep it fresh or novel. And there are definitely days where we let them run it. It's like, we have this idea in mind and they're like, listen, dude, like, I don't want to do the circuit today. I just want to get stretched. And it's like, yeah, man, like, we can do that. And so we have to be flexible as well. And I think with all people, it's just a matter of finding out, like, hey, what is this one thing we can do? What's going to give you the most benefit, bang for your buck? Like, what do you want? What do you think is a limiting factor in your performance or in your health right now? What do you need help with? What do you wish you were doing better? And a lot of time when you put the ball in their court, they're a lot more, and you show you have their best interests in mind and you care, then you get a lot. It's a lot easier to get buy-in, because I think we would all agree that there's probably infinite ways which we can help performance. There's definitely some things that may be better than others. But like you can't discount the power of their experience and what they think. Again, if we know why manual therapy works or ways in which it works from a top down way, from a brain body way, as opposed to a body brain way, then like you can start to imagine that, like, hey, what this person has done to get ready for 10 years might not need to be addressed. Maybe I don't want to be doing TKEs with this person, but like, he's not in knee pain. He's like, and it's one little thing for 5 minutes on one day. Like, we can do that. That's fine. You know what I mean? That's part of his routine. So, it's like you try not to worry about the minutiae, and you try and hit the big rocks. So I don't know if that helps.
No, that's an awesome answer, Michael. I think like one theme I get throughout that I was speaking to someone about the other day is that we have to remember there's just so much discussion on Twitter and in places of exactly what you said, the minutiae of training and like, I don't know where that is on the radar screen for people who actually work in pro sports and Olympic sports, because what, you know, the boxes we need to tick are feasibility and, you know, what's going to make the athletes actually trust in what we're doing and feel comfortable and feel like it's doing them good. You know, those are some of the big rocks, aren't they?
Yeah. And again, like I appreciate the minutiae. Like, I want to understand the minutiae. I want to know the minutiae. I want to know what's ideal. But just realizing for tons of reason, that would probably be the discussion on a whole other podcast. It's like, these dudes are often over the age of 25. So we know they're probably already hit the peak of their athleticism. A lot of them don't have the training experience of truly training and lifting and doing anything that's probably been regimented to their benefit. The reason that they're here, especially in American sports, is we get away with the fact that we have 320 million people and a ton of genetic and ethnic diversity, that we get the best of the best. So like, we can drive our athletes into the ground and the best rise to the top, and we have a lot of them. So it's like, we might not need to care so much about the minutiae with these people, because they've stood the test of time. And silly programming, overuse, youth sports specialization, and they're still here. So it's like, they don't have the training experience. Their regimented fitness is kind of been like, it's been throw things at a wall and see what sticks. And these people have happened to stick. They've already hit their genetic potential, most of them. They're on their decline, and it's like, and they're playing four times a week. So it's like, at what point are we going to, and like, we know, like, and this is from Val Niketson that I heard through someone else, it's like, we have 1.5 times a week where we can really train arduously. Like,
yeah,
that's how much we have in a non-drugged athlete, how much we can really push the envelope from a hormonal response system without like just burning them out. And well, we play 3.5 times a week. So it's like, how are you tempering an extra 2 times a week? And it's like, well, why do people get injured? It's like, well, this is probably a good reason for it. That thrown in with all the things we just discussed, and just crazy travel, like life things, like people with families and media commitments and all kinds of stuff. So it's like, I'm not using this to make excuses, but it's like the minutia is important. And like, I love the minutia personally, but this isn't necessarily the environment that gets you to, because we have such little control, and we're probably getting them a little bit too late in the process to really establish like a lot of things. And that's why it's like, what are the big rocks? Like, and then why are we training? Are we training qualities to produce force? Like, we have a block or a 2 week phase in our summer conditioning program where it's more like high velocity lifting against accommodating resistance, but it's 2 weeks and it's really just done as a way to prep their body for forces that, and efforts that are hard and difficult them, where they have an intent of something external, in this pace, a speed, like they will to some degree in games, but with different modes and different mediums. And it's just a short phase to get them ready to be able to exert themselves in a different strategy, like on the court when they start playing. So it's like, we have like parts of those phases in there, but like they're adjusted to make sure we can do them without tons of overload to their body, without jacking them up, knowing they're going to be playing basketball after they do this. So now it's not just like, it's not a stimulus that they're receiving once, but it's essentially a stimulus that they're receiving twice. And we just want to make sure that it doesn't like bang up their tendons and things like that too. So it's a small piece of the pie, but we're probably doing it for a different reason than just like pure force production. Like, we are just, we're trying to expose their body to an anaerobic stimulus or an alactic stimulus. Not that maybe that's not a good term to use, but like where we care about speeds and power outputs. And it's like, it's so much of the off season is then spent like loading their muscles and loading their joints in different ways than what they're going to be experiencing in, during play. So it's like, why are we training these dudes, and what are we trying to get out of them? Are we really going to improve their speed? Are we really going to improve their vert? Is their vert that we test one day and we test it a week later, is it down or up because of preparedness, or is it down or up because of readiness? And just knowing how much they're playing and all this stuff, even in the off season, like how much of this is going on because of the fact that they're just tired and they just got back from a three-day vacation when we tested them on Monday. So it's, you have to collect enough, and you have to put it against the context and the realization of why are these numbers what they are, and then if some, like the best basketball players I've worked with didn't have the highest verts at all, like it's like is that really what we want to be searching for them? And then devoting all our time to these physical qualities, does that make them stiffer? Does that make them less fluid? Does that take time away from other things that have made them a good athlete? You know, so it's like, it's what does this person need? How can we help them achieve that? One of the easiest way of doing that is if people are somewhat regularly stiff or painful or have issues with like a movement or a thing. And it's then like, oh, is this a fatigue thing? Is it after games? And then we can kind of condition them or rehab them in conjunction with normal training that allows you to kind of work on those things and dampen the effects of what they're saying. But a lot of times that, like, I care more about what they're telling me than like what objective numbers may say about their athleticism. Because again, if they're probably athletic enough, if they're here, and we know they're probably not going to have a ton of time to work on their athleticism to devote to it for all the things we mentioned. And they're probably on the genetic decline anyway by the time we're working with them. So, or their training history is just not great. You know what I mean? So it's just a lot. Like, there's a lot. And I don't think enough people appreciate kind of all the things or the things that we try and think of as a staff to utilize what it is that we utilize. Because I think a lot of things do work. But I think oftentimes people have like their specific things that they believe make a good athlete. And like, this is why I've tried, this is why I became a PT and I have a strength conditioning background. Like I try and learn as much as I can in all facets about everything. Psychology is important. What changes behavior? Like all of those things matter when you're working with humans. And it's like, how do we appreciate all of these factors which might influence what it is their body is being subjected to, how their body is adapting to it, and then what can we do to hopefully induce positive adaptation so that they feel like they're ready and they can play and they're subjected to things that do have some degree of transfer physically to what they're doing on the court. There's some degree of transfer between what we're doing with them and what they're doing on the court.
Yeah, one would hope so, given our professions, right?
Right.
It escapes the attention with too many, so it's great to hear someone who's really focused on that. Michael, what's something that you have changed your mind about in the last year, and why?
Lots. But like I would say, like my big rocks have always been like pretty consistent. It's how can I apply them better, and maybe it's this. I don't think we can be so sure. It's like, again, so I'm a PT, I'm a strength coach. Like that's my background. That's how I look. That's kind of how I appraise the body. And it's how it's like, it's more of what my intervention is.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's like, I'm a lot more realistic about like, who am I to say that despite this, the fact that this person can't pronate or can't do a set of 20 pushups, but like he can go on a court and he's in the NBA and he can jump. Like it's like we ask some of our athletes to jump and land, and these are some of our most explosive, like best jumpers, like the people you would associate with being the best dunkers, and they look like baby deer sometimes just yeah. trying to walk. So So I don't know if that I've changed my mind so much as it's like, wow, I've realized that a lot of things probably go into why this person can perform on a court at 7:30, mm-hmm. 3.5 times a week. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. is he jumping like crap because he doesn't have a ball in his hand? Like, series of I won't say the name, but like I heard someone tell me that this person was just trying to do a half kneeling chop and lift or a half kneeling, I believe it was a lift with like a cook bar. And was falling all over the place. But there's like, I don't know if it's Spalding or what brand the basketball they have. You can attach instead of a cook bar, basketball on a hook. And as soon as you put the ball in his hand, he buried the exercise. He was stable and he wasn't falling over. And
that's like, crazy. That's awesome.
Like, what, and again, like, I don't. This is hearsay, so I don't know how true it is. But I believe the guy who told me. And then you see it. It's like, is this person jumping like this because he doesn't have a ball in his hand? Because he's jumping off 2 feet when he's used to doing like an approach jump? Is it because he's used to landing very stiff so that he can get like he's not fluid in his force absorption? Is it because it's 11 o'clock in the morning and he's not really mentally into it? Is it because he's in a weight room? It's just like we don't know a lot of why these people can do what they can do or why they aren't doing what you would assume they could do. And it's like, it's just, it makes, so then I'm willing to say like, hey, maybe for this person, this dude doesn't need to lift weights. Like you hear stories about like, and maybe they're genetic anomalies, but like they go out, they party and they still show up and play. So it's like, does nutrition, does sleep, does it really matter for everybody? And I'm going to say it has to matter. Like if they're robbing Peter, they got to pay Paul somewhere along their line or in their physiology. But like it might not mean they can't play. So when we're saying all this stuff is to improve your performance, it's like, well, his performance, there's a standard of performance he wants to reach. Like you can't be better than Michael Jordan. Couldn't have been better. He was the best ever. So like maybe if he ate more, I don't know anything about Michael Jordan. I'm just using him as a, like a, as an example. It's like, does he need to eat more broccoli? Like if he ate too much sugar, it's like, no, he's the best ever. Yeah, so exactly. I think people realize that like this is the case, but I've just come to grips a lot more. It's like, all right, you don't think what I have to offer you, or you're not feeling what I'm putting down right now. Like, what is it that you feel like you need? And let's work on that. And like, it doesn't need to be strength conditioning. Maybe it just needs to be massaged regularly, or like, because you've always felt better when doing that. And who am I to tell someone who's like the top 0.5% in their profession that they need me or they need something else? Like, these dudes don't need us. They only need us when they do. And like, I guess, I think I always kind of had that idea, but like, it's just solidified more and more each year that I'm in this crazy sport, man. It really is. It's like survival of the fittest. It's a lot of things go into why these dudes are feeling the way they are. When you're winning, no one's hurt. No one's banged up. Everybody's subjective questionnaires are great. The mood is chipper. It's like when you lose a couple games, it ain't like that. Now knees are sore. Now muscles are sore. And it's just, there's a lot of things that go into this. So it's made me realize how little I matter, which is kind of humbling, but it's also kind of cool. It's like, man, like this is, I think it's kind of cool. You know what I mean? How then do I figure out, how do I relate to this person and how can I get them to do something for their benefit? And maybe that's just talking with them.
Exactly. And that's the one, Michael, because yeah, I mean that the human nature that you just talked about with, you know, when you're winning, no one's hurt. And like you said about, you know, there's some guys who are going to go out and party every night and they play just fine. So what that tells me is what battles should we be picking as a practitioner, as a member of staff, is maybe it's a lost cause to try and go and get them to get 10 hours of sleep every night. Maybe right. We need to get them to foam roll more, or to try and eat a little bit better when they're under your watch and those things, you know?
Or maybe it just pisses a grown man off when you continually ask him the same thing or to do the same thing over and over again. Like,
exactly.
Then it's like, now what you do say to them has no credence because you've worn them out. So I think there's like, we have to remember sometimes that, yeah, some of these dudes are kids, but some of these dudes have been playing, especially in the teams that I've been on, like, we haven't had a ton of rookies. Like, we haven't had a ton of youngins. Like, I haven't had any 18 or 19-year-old pros. So it's like, these dudes have been doing it for 3-4 years, or they played 4 years in college or 3 years in college. So they're a little bit older a lot of times, and like, they know what they need.
All right, lightning round to finish up the interview. So 30 seconds or less, answer for each. What is a book you've read or film you've watched that has influenced you in the past year?
The guy's name is Ta-Nehisi Coates. I want to say it's called The World Between Me. And it was an unreal book. I saw one of our players reading it, and actually everybody on our staff has read it. It was unreal. And I just read it like a week ago, and it essentially puts like context of what it's like. Again, I'm a white dude. We're all white staff who happens to be working in a sport that's dominated by African Americans. And it's like, perspective, it's always good, and empathy are always good if you want to try and be able to relate to someone. And reading something from of a firsthand account that's written in the form of a letter to his son about kind of what it's like, his journey about like learning about what it means to be black in America, is pretty powerful. So I'm messing up. I think it's called The World Between Me.
Well, we'll find it on Amazon and put a link.
Between the World and Me, it's called. Yep.
Between the World and Me. Okay, awesome. We'll put that in the show notes.
And then I read another book recently called When Breath Becomes Air. And they're both super
I've seen people tweeting that one, yeah.
And like, that was just like, talk about a dude who gets it. And like, I think I'd like to leave a legacy, whatever that means, with the people that I encounter on any given day. Like, you can tell that both these dudes will. And When Breath Becomes Air, it's a phenomenal read about perspective and like kind of the meaning of life and stuff. It was good.
Awesome, man. Those will both be in the show notes. What is a historical character, or really anybody dead or alive, whom you haven't met, who you would like to?
Ooh, this is tough too. Ben Franklin would be pretty cool for me, just because of kind of like how good he was in a lot of multiple aspects of life. Like, he had a pretty extensive resume and was pretty successful in all of them. Diplomat, inventor, writer. So I would say Ben Franklin.
Nice. I like that. What would be your three keys to performance in keeping athletes healthy and ready to play?
So I'm going to go back on what I said before, but training, nutrition, and rest, sleep.
Yeah.
Those three things we know always have benefits. And how we go about getting those things, I think are can be very tough. Changing habits is tough, but those are the three most important things. Train, eat well, sleep a lot.
Michael Roncarotti, Director of Rehabilitation with the Atlanta Hawks. Thanks for your time today, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Check back soon for a great interview with Portland Trail Blazers strength and conditioning coach, Ben Canyon. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.